Devil We Know contains graphic content and intense subject matter. Listener discretion is advised. Everywhere we look, everywhere we go, every city, every town, every neighborhood, every street, there is a devil we know. This is Devil We Know, and I am your host, Aaron. The entirety of North America is considered the third largest continent in the world. It may not sound like much, after all, third place only ever places in the most competitive contests. Everyone already knows that Asia takes the cake there, sure, but North America in its totality makes up for approximately 9.5 million square miles. That, quite literally, is a lot of ground to cover. So picture for a moment that a person wanted to do harm to others. Now suppose that person didn't want to get caught. Well, traveling across the North American continent just to scratch an itch isn't exactly instant gratification, but it does accomplish the more pressing goal. It makes the person incredibly hard to nail down. No matter who is committing crimes, and no matter what crimes are committed, it's always been a universal rule that committing crime in your own backyard brings the heat directly to you. Someone comes sniffing around, whether it's local law enforcement or the FBI. Well, that's the thinking, isn't it? But what if someone's activity across multiple states actually drew more attention? Isn't that what you see in the movies? Like the runaway outlaws from the days of early cinema? There are some bad guys that grow into carelessness of sorts, whether it's they've gotten bored, or whether they feel rushed, harried, watched, it doesn't really matter. With Big Brother's eyes everywhere, it's increasingly more difficult to exist outside the law. There are flaws, but some of the oldest blind spots have since been filled. The government knows more about those who scratch their itches than ever before. And this knowledge is only becoming more and more comprehensive as technology and intelligence improve. However clever a person can be, one slip-up is all it takes to bring a Texas-sized thunderstorm on the crime parade. And when that happens, only one solid rule remains in the minds of criminals abound. They have to run. That, and they have to hope that they're faster than the people behind them. Anchorage winds bit at the face of Israel Keys as he readied himself for the next part of his plan. He had taken his time when dealing with the body of his latest victim, Samantha Koenig, and now it was time to act once more to perpetuate his life of crime. His actions, while hurried at first, suddenly became sparse, spread out, after he had raped Samantha and then taken her life. First, he stuffed the lifeless body of Samantha Koenig in the shed outside his home, wrapped inside a tarp and kept from rotting by violent cold air that permeated the walls of the shed. The body lay nearly frozen, awaited recovery. That wait went on for quite a while, because Israel hid the evidence of his latest kill. He then went on a cruise and a crime spree, committing arson and robbing more than one location while in Texas, far south of his most recent crime. It was a routine that he'd grow used to, and his customs were becoming so familiar that they were likely beginning to lose their edge. He probably felt comfortable, and more than that, Israel likely had grown complacent in his criminal activity. No longer the martinet, no longer the attentive lone wolf, he soon found himself breaking his own rules. Even after he had taken Samantha hostage in his own town, Israel didn't know it, but his regime as an apex predator had started to become undone. The way home was paved with fire and blood for Israel. But once he landed back in Anchorage, he regrouped with his daughter and girlfriend, whose opinions of him remained unsullied by the truth of his actions. To them, he was simply the father, the lover, the friendly working man. To them, there was no knowledge of Samantha Koenig. But Israel did not wait long before also making time for dead Samantha as well. Upon his return home, he made time to violate the body and prepare it for the post-mortem photo shoot. In the photo he took, he guised up Samantha's corpse to look alive, and then Israel sent the photo alongside a ransom note. His dangerous game was afoot, and with Samantha's ransom safely deposited into her debit card, Israel took confidence in the decision to finally dispose of Samantha. He proceeded to cut up her body. Once he had hacked the corpse sufficiently, he loaded up Samantha's remains and drove north of Anchorage. There he stopped at a popular fishing spot and hiking area known as Matanuska Lake. Not only was this place frozen over right now, but the wilderness of remote lakes and hiking trails were a favorite spot of Israel's. But he had to save this enjoyment for another trip, as he now had work to do. He went out to the surface of the frozen lake with the dismembered pieces of Samantha. He then cut the ice layer atop the lake, letting him dump his latest victim's remains down into the steep, murky blue beneath the ice. He then began to do some ice fishing to complete the day. Israel caught a fish and took it home to eat, a detail that when later shared would make an investigator sick as he thought about it. Israel felt he had done his part to get rid of the evidence. He thought to himself, ironically, he did this with Samantha's ATM card still in his possession. This mistake, he would learn, would soon cost him more than just one victim. It would, when the time came, cost him his entire criminal career. Israel was in no rush to reap all the spoils of his latest crimes all at once. His typical MO involved stashing money and weapons in strategic locations all throughout the United States. His activity would begin with a flight to a city, usually with a leg of driving and a rental as well, to acquire his stash of weapons and cash. The news later called them kill kits, or murder kits, and take it to yet another town, where he had scouted out ideal locations for abducting, raping, extorting, robbing, and killing all sorts of unsuspecting strangers. He was mainly interested in what the location had to offer him, and he was not so picky about strangers he took. He once mentioned that he does prefer that his victims be light so he could carry them away, but that wasn't an exclusive, hard and fast rule. For him to attain such a level of success in his criminal activity, however, Israel did establish some rules intended to be hard and fast. These rules were what allowed him to continue his lifestyle of killing and other crimes for over a decade, undetected by the government's best and brightest. His rules included the most obvious one: not to shit where he ate. In other words, he avoided killing people wherever he was currently living. With the murder of Samantha Koenig being an exception to this rule, Israel's go-to in achieving compliance was the traveling he did, from city to city, flying and driving, avoiding as much connection with the place of a murder as possible. Local disposal of the evidence in his secretive fashion and calm intention when leaving the area helped him with his performance under the radar, but the fact that he typically lived nowhere near the location of his crimes added to this list of factors, and carried with it great weight. Another rule he had, to never use his own vehicle for abductions, was broken in his abduction of Samantha. He typically used the victim's car for these scenarios, and in Samantha's case, he didn't even wait for Dwayne to show up with the car. He used his own truck instead. Along with these rules, Israel had trained himself to take the battery out of his cell phone when on a kill trip. He was often found using cash instead of a card to allow less chance of a paper trail during these stints. It was clear that Israel had a system, and when he stuck to it, it worked so well that he had yet to be caught or even suspected of such a crime. However, the fact that Israel had taken Samantha Koenig's ATM card now meant that someone was going to be on the lookout. Unfortunately for Israel, the search was a lot shorter than he could have ever expected. Israel left Anchorage yet again in early March. Whether that trip was intended to lead to another kill, or if Israel was planning to set himself up for a future crime spree in a far-off destination. His first stop was when he flew into Las Vegas, Nevada. As always, Israel saw fit to rent a car from the airport in order to complete the next leg of his trip. Wherever he headed next, it was safe to assume that there was a plan in mind. For his plans, though, Israel needed some cash. He knew, though, that he already had a decent supply available to him. He just needed to remain careful, as the ransom money to which he had access was only available by using the ATM card that Samantha had told him about. Planning to pull out several withdrawals at different locations to avoid triggering certain cash withdrawal alerts, he first stopped at an ATM in Wilcox, Arizona, taking a few $100s from the account. In less than 2 hours, a disguised Israel Keys was then in New Mexico, and he withdrew money using the same card in Lordsburg. He knew, of course, that the ATMs were going to be watched, but he thought that by coming prepared with a disguise that he would surely escape the prying eyes of investigators. But he was wrong. He may have been able to hide his own identity, but unbeknownst to Israel, the make and model of the rental he was driving across several states was identified using the footage from one of those ATMs. It was easy for investigators to recognize the white Ford Focus as the camera relayed it on screen. Israel even found trouble with the car and took it to the rental agency nearby to receive a trade-in rental. Unluckily for him, the trade-in vehicle that was rented turned out to be none other than a white Ford Focus. Not only did he stay in the same vehicle after it had been identified by police, but by the time Samantha's card had been used twice in a row by Israel, the FBI had found their way into the investigation. The utilization of the stolen card across state lines, that is, from Arizona to New Mexico, made it highly possible that the authorities were looking at a multi-state kidnapping. And committing a crime like that across multiple states is a matter that is often reserved for the FBI. In other words, the FBI was now involved, and Israel kept unknowingly bringing that straight to him. It wasn't long before Israel found himself back in the Lone Star State once more. And the fact that he felt relatively comfortable when he reached Humble City, Texas, was incredibly clear. He was so comfortable, in fact, that he decided to cease his interstate journey yet again to use another ATM. It was March 9th, 2012, and his use of the ATMs across the states attracted the FBI's attention in what is called excessive device fraud, of which Israel was plainly guilty. Since the debit card linked to Samantha Koenig and Dwayne Tortolani's bank account had been involved in the night of Samantha's disappearance, and Israel's request for a ransom involved the same bank account. Authorities were already watching the activity closely. The fact that someone, somewhere, was milking this account for all it was worth indicated to police that something was amiss, and they assumed that if they followed the person who was committing the fraudulent activity, they might just find out where Samantha would be. Israel took this last withdrawal, an ATM in Humble City, and FBI officials saw the activity immediately. When they connected the dots between these transactions, the FBI then alerted the local and state authorities to be on the lookout. From the footage taken at an earlier ATM, they had reason to believe that their mystery man was driving a white Ford Focus in the vicinity. It wasn't much, but evidently it was enough for the Texas Highway Patrol. Corporal Brian Henry was out on duty when he identified the exact same car, make and model, at a hotel in Lufkin, Texas. Israel had thought that he would take a load off, and he was unaware of the attention his actions had attracted. Corporal Henry knew, of course, that the individual wanted was suspected in Alaska for other crimes, so he waited for the mystery man, Israel Keyes, to emerge from the motel. Henry followed on no more than the vehicle description and a hunch, making sure that he didn't raise the alarm for the potentially dangerous individual. He was going to be sure before he made any concrete decisions. Then, Corporal Henry found a way in. Israel committed another crime before his very eyes. Henry took Israel's driving speed and noticed that he was driving 3 miles per hour over the speed limit. While this was a little more than a minor traffic violation, Henry had what he needed to pull Israel over and inspect the situation. Corporal Henry pulled Israel over, having ensured that he would have backup on standby if his suspicions were confirmed. He then approached what looked like a normal guy, who greeted the corporal from his driver's side window. Corporal Henry noticed that the face of the driver looked a lot like the picture that he was briefed with. However, he could not assume that he'd found the culprit of so much criminal activity at a glance. He asked Israel for his driver's license, a request to which Israel complied. After all, he was only speeding a little bit. Corporal Brian Henry had the driver's license in hand, and he ran it. He also saw the state that it was from, Alaska, which suddenly confirmed his suspicions that his hunch was more than that. He had caught the man that was suspected in the abduction of a girl in Anchorage, Alaska. He realized that Israel really did look like those photos from the ATM, and that is when Corporal Henry called for backup. He then established probable cause, telling Israel that he needed to search the vehicle. That's when Henry came across the mask that Israel wore in his pictures from the ATM. Along with that, Corporal Henry discovered Israel's robbery money, stained with the dye packs that indicate ill-gotten goods from any bank. He found a gun, one of many in Israel's ownership, which he had used for the armed robberies he committed. And lastly, Henry found a debit card belonging not to Israel, but to a certain Samantha Koenig. Corporal Henry took this opportunity to place Israel under arrest. It seemed that Henry had hit the jackpot. He had found the FBI's guy. But Henry, the Alaska police, and even the FBI had no idea exactly what kind of criminal they had just unearthed. Israel willing, though, they would soon find out. Israel had left a long past behind him in the years leading up to that day in March 2012. When he was extradited back to Alaska for being suspected in Samantha's abduction, however, while in the Anchorage jail, Israel remained silent about his colorful past for quite a while. He was visited by investigators attempting to broach the subject of Samantha's case, of course. But it was all for naught. It wasn't until the end of March that Israel gave in, for the first time admitting that he had abducted Samantha. He gave his full confession on the condition with the investigators that his daughter, Lainey, would not hear about the things that he did. Israel was attempting as early as March to secure them and to maintain control over the interrogations. And it was clear that if the investigators wanted to know what Israel did with Samantha, they would have to play ball. It wasn't until Israel said that he had lots of stories to tell that the authorities realized the truth. They had been looking for a kidnapper, and they had found themselves a serial killer instead. And this one had been many years in the making. We will be right back after these messages.
Hi there, I'm Levi Page. I'm a journalist and host of the true crime podcast, Crime and Scandal. Join me every week as I take a deep dive into scandalous true crime stories and unsolved mysteries. On Crime and Scandal, I have episodes up on the shooting of Trayvon Martin, the young man shot to death by a trigger-happy neighborhood watchman in Florida, the Darlie Routier murder case. A young woman is convicted in the 90s for the brutal stabbing death of her two children. Could she actually be innocent? Plus, I examined the child abuse allegations that followed pop star Michael Jackson for decades before his death. Are you interested yet? Those are just some of the topics I tackle. If you want to start listening, search Crime and Scandal in your Apple Podcasts app or wherever you listen to podcasts and subscribe now. That's Crime and Scandal.
Born to parents of the Church of Latter-day Saints in 1978, Israel Keyes remained homeschooled alongside the rest of his 9 siblings. With many siblings, highly religious parents with a desire to keep outside influences from their children, and a steady increase in strangeness of living locations, it's not hard to surmise that Israel's ideals and sense of direction may have been a bit muddled. Although he was born in Richmond, Utah, Israel did not remain there forever. Israel's parents moved their family from their home in Utah to Stevens County in Washington State. In Washington, the family then found themselves not only straying from Utah, but from the Mormon church as well. They began to attend services at a Christian identity church, soon discovered to be a cult called the Ark, which was steeped in ideologies that encouraged racism and even more specifically, anti-Semitism. It was clear that although the Keyes family remained homeschooled, this church just up the road from them espoused and had indoctrinated certain values that would now be considered criminal hatred. At this church, the belief that white people have a sovereign right as the dominant race are preached regularly. In addition, this real-life cult teaches the idea that the Hebrews of the Bible did not beget the modern-day Jew as their progeny, but instead the white race. In line with this belief, many churches within the Christian identity cult believe that the Jewish nation is actually the progeny of the devil himself. And Israel and his family heard these messages as they learned the names of their fellow cult members. In fact, the Keys made fast friends with another family in this church who happened to be their neighbors, the Kehoe family. Chevy and Chain Kehoe, boyhood chums of Israel Keys, actually grew up to become the infamous terrorist duo convicted of murder and attempted murder in 1996. But before that, they were friends with Israel, and in growing under the guidance of the hate-mongering at the Ark. They were molded well in the thinking that led to their stint as racist killers. It was clear after making this connection that the interplay there had also made its intended effect on Israel. He too became a killer, and his track record was a lot longer than most. While living in this community outside of Colville, Israel began to discover not only the violent sentiments of the church to which his family had begun offering their religious devotion, but he also began to probe and poke at the very fabric of his own violent sentiments. In an interview, Israel shared an instance in which he demonstrated his hatred and his complete disregard for animals. Israel, speaking to his sister, threatened to kill the family cat if he continued getting into the trash, as it often did. And soon, Israel took the cat out into the woods, followed by 2 family friends and the sister he'd just talked to days before. He took the cat with him, a 10-foot-long cord and a revolver. Before long, they had reached a tree that Israel used to tie the cord on one end, while attaching it at the other to the cat. With the cord wrapped around the neck of the animal, Israel raised the handgun and shot at the cat and shot the cat in the stomach. The cat, still alive at this point, ran around the tree to which he was tethered and hit the tree, vomiting as it died slowly. Israel laughed, and as the friends watched on, one boy threw up and later told his father about the incident. While Israel did not become discouraged from performing tasks like this, he grew up much more secretive about his violent tendencies, as it dawned on him that he was different in a way from the other people who he had spent time with. It wasn't long before violent tendencies that got in the way of living his life with his family became a core focus of his activity. After moving from militant fundamentalist churches, like the Ark, to Amish-like lifestyles in which his parents stressed the prohibition of electrical appliances, Israel soon found himself taking an equivalency test to mark the completion of his high school from home. His next move after that was to join the military, where he served from the time he was 18 until the age of 20. It was during this time that he explored his violent urges at a whole new level, taking a girl from her group in the Deschutes River area in Oregon so that he could rape her. He even meant her to be his first murder victim. However, he lost his nerve and didn't complete the act. The woman ran and rejoined her group after convincing Israel not to kill her, but she never did report the act. However, Israel's close call forced him to lay low, and he served in Egypt for 6 months, also working at Fort Hood in Texas and Fort Lewis in Washington State. In the army, Israel was noted for being the quiet guy, and his weekends consisted of habitual binge drinking. This disturbing behavior, though, did not prevent him from earning recognition and prowess in the military as he continued to work heavily in his career as a specialist. In 2001, Israel was honorably discharged, and it's assumed that his life with the army was relatively unsullied by criminal activity. Even if he simply didn't admit to committing any crimes while in the military's employ, his skill and deceit would simply be a testament to the fact that law enforcement may never know the awful truth. Regardless, according to Israel, his first murder was committed shortly after leaving the military in the late summer or early fall of 2001. He later commented that it would have perhaps been better for him if he had stayed in the military for longer. And of course, we can never know if that would be the case, because his admissions only provided so much insight into the mysterious past of Israel Keyes. Israel was able to maintain personal relationships throughout his life, despite his dispositions to violence. When he discovered that his behavior was unacceptable to those around him, he learned to adjust and not to share the darker aspects of his life with anyone. Instead, he repressed it or hid it between long spreads of regular activity. In the army, he had his army buddies, and they associated with him without trepidation, as he had already adapted his behavior to fit the norm. In the same way, when Israel moved out to Washington and began living in Nia Bay, and he began to take work as a contractor for the Makah tribe, which lived there, while living in Nia Bay, he met a girl, and they had a daughter together, and after they broke up, he even fought for partial custody. It was noted by all the citizens of Nia Bay that during his years there, Israel's conduct was indicative of a model citizen. He worked hard, earned happy clients, cared for his child, and made friends. His prowess among the unsuspecting was impressive, as all the townsfolk were none the wiser when it came to Israel's true and gruesome past. It was during this time, though, that Israel had come to establish this usual method of execution, when he did make the clandestine killing trips in whatever area of the country he had selected. Although he did not share with police the locations of every kill, or even how many there were in total, it's evident that his methods were well thought out and meticulously planned. The impression he had of a place were what became integral when selecting a victim. And as he flew out to the general direction of a prime spot for killing, stealing, or raping, he picked up materials of dead drops he left all over the country. These drops filled with weapons, money, and other nefarious items, as stated earlier, the kill kits, by the media, and in truth, they were a large mechanic in the intricate system of the resources which Israel employed in his criminal quests. He also mentioned that he would regularly drive out from where he flew, particularly because he didn't want to have to fly the weapons with him, and partially because he found it much more preferable to await the opportune victim in a quiet place, removed from the busy world of major cities. His preference was for locations where people came to get away. In one of his interviews with the FBI, he suggests that usual practice he employed in luring and abducting victims, from which the FBI attempted to glean an understanding of whom he might have killed. This is a recording of a time when he shared this information with the FBI during an interrogation.
So going back to when you get out of the army, Lainey is born and you're living in Nia Bay. Is that right?
Yeah.
And you said it was you had a lot of downtime and you'd been kind of holding back on the stuff that you were thinking about doing. What set that free? What made it kind of go to the step where you were to act?
Yeah, I don't know if I want to talk about that yet.
There was something? I mean, some an event? Or
There was stuff that happened when I was in Nia Bay, yeah. I just don't know if I want to give the whole timeline on it right now.
Well, don't give me the timeline. I'm just the thought process or what made it change?
Well, it, like I say, I got out of the Army, and anytime I'd get to where I had downtime, or, you know, if I would leave Nia Bay, get out of Nia Bay. Mm-hmm. And all that stuff was still there, you know. And like, every time I'd drive, make a drive somewhere, I'd be looking for places, good places to do stuff. At that point, I had, you know, I just accepted it was only a matter of time and opportunity before I did something again. I just had decided by then that I wasn't going to do anything quite as compulsive, I guess. I decided to plan it out a little better or something.
Well, it seems like even from when you were in Oregon, you planned out taking that girl. That's pretty well planned.
Yeah, it was, but it was mostly just the situation that worked out, because, I mean, I hadn't even lived there very long when I did that.
You didn't know the area very well.
Yeah, I didn't know. I didn't know what to expect or anything. My thought process had always been that if there's not a body, then, you know, just like, if there's not a body and not any witnesses, then, you know, there's a big search or whatever sometimes, but if the person's not connected to me, then I probably won't ever even be questioned about it or whatever, so. Mm-hmm.
And did that work? That's the way it worked, right?
Well, yeah. I was just convinced that I had screwed up that time in Oregon because, you know, I let her go.
Up until the time you were arrested in Texas, had you ever been questioned before about any of the murders that you committed?
No.
No one ever stopped you? Questioned you? How about any rapes? Anybody ever questioned you about any of
No.
How about any other crimes you committed? Were you ever questioned?
No. Well, I mean, there was like really minor stuff that happened when I was a teenager when I was breaking into houses, but not.
You told us the other day that you could tell, you know, because you were trying to, you knew you didn't want to get caught. How would you identify a victim so that you would, you know, try to decrease the chances that you would be caught?
Well, back when I was smart, I would do it. I would let them come to me.
I don't understand.
Just remote area. You know, not.
Kind of
go to a remote area that's not anywhere near where you live, but that other people go to as well. You might not get exactly what you're... There's not as much to choose from, in a manner of speaking, but there's also no witnesses, really. There's nobody else around, so... And then when they... When they disappear, a lot of times, nobody's really surprised, because it happens all the time.
The way that Israel figured out who he was going to kill was a crucial distinction, as Israel's profile with the FBI continued to change according to this information. Not only did he indicate that he was not particularly picky about the type of victims he chose, which in itself is only characteristic of a percentage of the serial killer population, he also shared that this methodology for finding and abducting victims had evolved from his ability to think in extremes and adaptability that is often, but not always, shared by his fellows. What made matters worse, though, was that Israel was intelligent in how he handled the murders and the aftermath. His propensity toward caution and paranoia led Israel to habitually make his murders look as though they were accidents, with a percentage of success that only he can be entirely sure of. He discusses this as well with the police during the same interview.
See, that's the part I'm trying to...
Marathon runner.
The Mount Marathon guy?
Mm-hmm. But what I'm trying to figure out, so, but if somebody's camping in a remote spot, someone's going to know that they didn't come home.
Right.
So did you have other things you looked for in a victim?
No, it was, you know, it's just... You asking what type of people I would pick, or
yeah, what type, or whether there was a way?
I didn't really have a type.
Okay.
I had preference, but that it wasn't.
What's the preference?
Well, lightweight.
Is that because of attraction or because of disposal?
Yeah, it's kind of makes it easier.
Okay.
But. You know, it's not. It's not a deal breaker. No, I don't know. I just. Yeah. Like I say, like when the couriers, that was. Well. No, there were a couple other times, but I don't know. There are places where it always surprises me. You know, like some situations you read about in the paper, like so-and-so disappeared, presumed boating accident, for example. They find their boat. You don't know what really happened to that person. I'm not the only person who figured this out.
Do you think there's a lot of people like you out there?
No, but I don't think it takes a lot, you know? And like I say, if you're not picky, if you can control your... If I had been able to control myself, then, you know, who knows, you know, how long... I don't know.
Are you telling us that there's bodies that have been found that were accidental deaths that ruled like that or that looked like that? Is that what you're telling us?
Well, maybe one. But for the most part, for me, no. I'm just saying as an example.
Someone might say, oh, it looks like a boating accident, but you knew.
Boating accident. My hiker disappears.
Fire.
Fires.
So on one instance where you killed somebody, it appeared in the news as if it were an accident. So that's got to be kind of empowering.
But, well, right. I never took that for granted, though. Because I've known for a long time, because of the things that I've done that have been in the news, I've known that like what you read that happened and what I know that actually happened, sometimes it's almost not even recognizable, really. So I never took it for granted. I always assumed that if a body was found that somebody was going to be after me for it. I was always prepared for that, and I always thought I had alibis and stuff. Like, it was always in the back of my mind. It's kind of hard to keep track of after a while, but, you know.
But you anticipate if they found the body, here's what my story's going to be.
Right.
Were there any close calls where they found the body and you were prepared, kind of prepared for that?
Well, like I say, I don't know if it was a close call. I don't know. I know that what was made public, it never seemed like it was close to me.
But the body recovered, and you were worried they were going to come ask questions about it.
Yeah.
Was that only one time?
Yeah.
Did you consider that a mistake on your part? Somehow no. That the body was recovered?
Well, I don't.
Back then.
Yeah, it was a mistake. I mean,
what happened? Were you rushed? Did you not do something the way you planned?
No, I was. It was kind of the same situation as the couriers. I just wasn't in a position to get rid of it right away, and so I decided to try and make it look. I mean, it was already going to be assumed that it was an accident and of some sort, and my concern was that the body would be found before it had decomposed enough. But right away, it probably wouldn't have been thought to be an accident anymore.
Oh, okay. I read a story once about an elderly couple that, I think it was like an arson or something like that, where, you know, to like try to cover up the bodies. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Not specifically, but no, I know what you're saying.
Where they were probably killed, but they recovered the bodies in a, you know, in the house fire. And, you know, on inspection, they think they're probably dead before the fire. Too, so.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of thing?
Not only did the failure to mask this kill perturb Israel, but it gave him a sense of urgency in his attempts to remedy his methods. He states that he had a plan in place, and that his ability to create an alibi served him well in his paranoia and his attempts to avoid being found out by police. His belief that he had disguised his efforts was well-founded, because even in the times where he believed he might have been discovered, he kept cool and prepared himself for the most extreme outcomes. He also ensured that his stories always lined up with the facts that supported him. And until the case with Samantha Koenig, that practice had remained watertight. This is another thing that he elaborated on when he sat with the police in July of 2012.
That they wouldn't be able to figure out that it wasn't natural causes, kind of death.
So, like, you're talking about somebody just found in a house that wouldn't be missed for a really long time, something like that.
No. That's a good idea, though. It's kind of hard to figure out.
Well, like the couriers, if that house had remained standing for, 10 years or something, and then somebody went 10 years later, there wouldn't be much to find. Is that what you're...
No, in that case, I was planning to go back.
Right. But the other case you're talking about, you were not planning on going back.
Right.
But you thought enough time would pass that the bodies would decompose.
Enough. Yeah.
Were you worried that evidence of sexual assault or the method of death was going to be discovered
method of death.
Mm-hmm. So in that case, the bodies were found.
Body
was found. But nobody ever suspected foul play.
I don't know.
But it was enough time that you were...
I wasn't too worried about it.
How long?
I was concerned about it.
How long was it between the time that you left the body and the time it was discovered?
So that was my main concern, always to make sure it never got to that point.
Have you found the police in different parts of the country to be better or worse, or are you more concerned about?
It got a lot better in the last few years.
This person, how did they die?
Yeah, I don't want to.
Well, there's no bullets, I take it.
Well, no.
Well, and there's obviously no evidence of that. I don't know that you'd be giving away a big secret if they discovered this body and they thought it was an accident.
No, I know.
Well, it wouldn't have been an accident. You're thinking just natural causes. Someone found this person must have died and no one found them. Something like that. An older person dies in their bed, something like that. That's what I think you're talking about. If somebody who, you know, they're not going to suspect foul play, they probably think, well, they had a heart attack, they're old, and you found them a year later.
Or they think he was climbing Mount Marathon and...
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't know. You tell me.
And they found this hiker's body at the bottom of a canyon.
You tell me.
Anyway... I'm sure we'll talk about it at length eventually.
Great. But that, going back to what we were talking about earlier, so that was not this person whose body was found, that's not the first time you killed somebody. This is just, we're talking about something different. Something.
Well, I'm not going to give you a context, but no, it was a while ago. It's,
no. But not the first.
No.
How did you identify the target for the first person that you've been kind of working up to? How did you identify who that was going to be? Was it one of these where you go out and wait for somebody?
Yeah. Not really wait, but, you know. If you know an area, you can pretty much plan on who you're going to run into and what type of people and stuff.
That you're not going to have to wait too long for.
Right.
And this time, Lainey was young, so how did you get away from the house for long periods of time?
It went a lot better the second time than the first time.
The second time you killed somebody?
What was the first time? What went wrong with the first time?
No, I'm just saying, like, from that incident that happened on the river to when I actually did it the second... Second time I had someone actually tied up and stuff there.
Hmm. Was it a restroom like the first time or something?
No.
Campsite. Woods.
I had it. I had already had the area picked out and... But as far as I had a lot of areas picked out, I just had it set in my mind how it was going to happen, and I was determined that's the way it was going to happen that time. And once I didn't really matter where, I had several areas. It was kind of one of those things where first time the opportunity came up.
Were you were driving around, or were you camped out somewhere?
Well, I was. I guess you'd say I was going through several different areas kind of thing.
Did it go as planned then?
Yeah.
And you were gonna, the first time you were gonna strangle the girl, is that what you did the second time? Did you strangle her?
Yeah.
Were there any, did you have a knife or a gun?
Yeah.
Did you use the knife or the gun?
No.
And it seems like you talked about tying the woman up. Is that, did you tie this woman up?
Yeah, they were tied.
Was it one person?
No, I'm just pointing out I never said it was a woman.
It was clear to investigators that this cold-blooded killer was one of the most methodical they had come across or even heard of in their line of work. With Israel's nonchalant references to criminal conduct and the excitement he displayed in later, more detailed accounts, It's no wonder that the FBI had considered Israel likely to have killed at least a dozen people. And yet the man before them was showing himself as personable, casual, intelligent. The people they asked before had even considered him likable. It might have been strange, but the psychopathic features which Israel displayed in his behavior included the stereotypical aspects known as superficial charm. And according to the accounts from people all across the country, Israel had that charm in copious amounts. Many times, it's not the outcast who turns out to engender these specific psychopathic or murderous traits. Instead, a number of serial killers and people who fit the profile are well-loved, admired, considered good people by their contemporaries until such a time as their hellish actions are unveiled to the world. Whatever the case for most, though, Israel worked hard to keep up appearances. And no reason was more of a factor in the work than the arrival of Israel Keyes' daughter. Israel was said to have doted on his daughter, to have been a proud father by members of the community in which he lived. In Nia Bay, his co-workers spoke highly and said that it was obvious how much Israel loved his daughter. When he moved to Anchorage years later, the same was still said to be true. And even in his discussions with the FBI, his focus on future knowledge of him and his transgressions clearly troubled him to a great effect. In fact, the reason that his need for control in the later interrogation of 2012 was spurred on by the realization that Israel's image would likely be forever sullied should the media come out with the knowledge of a concrete connection between himself and the crimes he admitted to, such as sexual assault of Mrs. Currier and of Samantha Koenig. Although he helped his girlfriend to raise his daughter in Nia Bay for a time, the two eventually broke up and engaged in a legal custody battle. Israel lobbied for partial custody of his daughter, and soon he and his girlfriend made such an arrangement. It was clear, though, that Israel would be making other moves in his life, and he soon had himself a girlfriend, who he followed to Anchorage, Alaska in 2007. At this point in time, Israel took the initiative to create his own construction company, branded with his name. He was going to leave a legacy of a different sort in the eyes of the public, as he saw it. It also came to be an ideal cover for criminal activity, in which he regularly engaged. It wasn't long before, with Anchorage as his home base, Israel began to make more trips in pursuit of blood. Anchorage, in its remoteness, was apparently well-suited to this killer. It's difficult to know where Israel Keyes, the well-loved, and the Israel Keyes, the monstrous, overlap in his rich life history. What we do know is that Israel took on two different personas in order to keep up his criminal life. Taking a persona by day that all at once was a doting boyfriend and a father and a friendly, intelligent co-worker. It seems, though, that with the passage of enough time and the absence of blood, Israel grew restless in his lust again and again, to a point of action. His urge began to be too much for him, and he acted first by leaving and then by selecting a random victim. It may be argued, of course, that the abnormal conditions of his upbringing and other external influences contributed greatly to his disposition as a violent, narcissistic psychopath. However, it is argued in other circles that Israel Keyes, unfortunate as he was to experience such a childhood, was born a monster of criminal intent. It's hard to say. What is known is this. Israel Keyes performed despicable acts, and no matter what the conditions or the motivations, these acts were premeditated and decided upon by the man himself. His decision to break society's rules by raping, stealing, and killing others made him an outlaw. Not the other way around. It's by stealing you become a thief, by killing you become a killer. Israel's decision to do exactly that are what made him a criminal, an outlaw. And then they're the reason that discovery of his life story became so important to investigators out there. By cracking open a monster like Israel Keyes, you just might be able to see what makes them tick. And that is part two of a three-part series on Israel Keyes. Please join us next Friday for the completion. I want to say thank you to two people that left me great reviews this week. They did not leave their name. If you happen to leave me a review, please shoot me your name and location. I'll shout you out on here. I really appreciate all the five-star reviews. I don't really care what you type, but the five-star reviews are really helpful. You can reach this show, Devil We Know Podcast, on Twitter at Devil We Know Pod, Instagram at Devil We Know Pod, and Facebook at Devil We Know Podcast. This three-part series is being researched and written by David Young, edited by David Young, and I am your host, Aaron. We'll see you next week. Thank you.